It's the morning show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Lawmakers from both political parties want Governor Tony Evers to fire a staff member who he says recorded a meeting in May. Here's what we know. The governor and two Republican legislative leaders met over the phone. They focused on Wisconsin's stay-home order and COVID-19. Someone who works for the governor recorded the call, and it's public thanks to an open records request. Evers says the staff member was tasked with taking notes and that he didn't know about the recording. Aside from the politics here, it got us wondering, what's legal and beyond that, what's ethical? Katie Culver is an associate professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. She's also the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics. Katie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Keely.
How does Wisconsin law limit when people can record phone conversations?
So Wisconsin is what's known as a one-party consent state for recording. So that means that you and I are on this call. I could record it without asking your permission and not be in any legal trouble. The issue in this case, though, is that if someone is not a party to the call, then we run into more legal concerns. So the consent has to come from one person who's a party to the call. The question here is whether the person who recorded it actually could be considered a party to the call.
Okay, so somebody may have been listening to the call, but that doesn't necessarily make them a party to it?
Yes, that's the hot topic right now.
And is this common that there are states that have laws where as long as I'm one of the people talking, I don't have to check with anybody else to be legal in recording it?
Yep, there are a number of states that are one-party consent states. If we just drive a little bit south to Illinois, all of the parties to the call need to consent to a recording. And if you are recording a call that crosses state lines, then federal law applies, and that is multi-party consent as well.
Hmm. We're taking your calls as we talk with Katie Culver about recording and the ethics and the legality of recording phone calls or video chats, focusing on digital privacy right now. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about recording phone calls or conversations over different digital platforms? Have you ever recorded phone calls with your friends or family or for work? What are your practices? Help us understand what's on your mind by calling 800-642-1234 or emailing ideas@wpr.org. What happens, Katie, in a state where you know the phone call might involve multiple people and you're supposed to get permission, but maybe you didn't? I mean, how is that sorted out?
Well, it can be a crime. It can rise to the level of felony to record without consent. So it's taken quite seriously. But I think instead of focusing solely on the law, we also should be thinking about the ethics of this and whether it's right to be doing this even in a one-party consent state where it may be legal.
Right. And I mean, happy to go there right now. How do we try to figure out if that's an appropriate thing to do?
You know, actually, the world of journalism ethics provides us some guidance here. You know, this is a big question for reporters, whether you should be recording sources without their consent. And while it may be legal, I think there's a wide consensus that unless, you know, absent a compelling justification, it's not a choice that you should make. When reporters call to ask for advice on this, I usually say never go in through an open back window if you haven't first tried to knock on the door and ask to come in. So, if it's a truly compelling case where there's no other way to get this information and it's truly important to the public, it serves the public interest, then you may be able to justify a surreptitious recording. But in most cases, journalists would avoid it. I think that is a good standard for public officials to apply as well.
Interesting, because right now we're looking at it and it could very well affect the political realm here.
Oh, certainly. You've seen this incredibly politicized right from the get-go, from the minute that the word of the recording came out through the open records request. And again, this is one of those cases where, you know, had this choice not been made, if we didn't have this recording, we might be having much more important conversations about how the state did respond to the Supreme Court's ruling and whether we are okay reopening after Safer at Home, what the public health data look like. But we're spending a lot of time fighting about a surreptitious recording.
We're talking about phone recordings and privacy issues with Katie Culver. She's an associate professor from the Journalism School at UW-Madison. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Are you spending more time on the phone or on video chats right now? If you were an elected official, how do you think you'd feel if someone recorded a phone call with you without your consent? Would that be okay? What about the law or the ethical considerations are you thinking about right now? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Katie, this goes beyond phone calls, though. When we have video chats with many, many people, we have lots of teams from offices who are now meeting together like this. How does Wisconsin's law apply here? What should we think about?
Well, there are all sorts of different considerations. So one thing right now that has arisen is the question of telehealth visits. So if I'm visiting with my doctor, you know, what are my patient protections and how is my privacy protected there? When students meet with a university professor in office hours, could you accidentally trigger a recording and that student might disclose some highly sensitive information or even just average information that we want to keep private, even if it's nothing incendiary? So we're in this world right now where capture is so incredibly easy, but we haven't had a lot of conversations about what responsibilities come along with these technologies.
Well, and not just with recording them or having the recordings, but the responsibilities after it's already in existence, what we do with that, whether we can delete it or not, I assume would depend on whether we're subject to open records requests or if it might be an ethical violation for us to delete something, even if it was accidentally recorded. This is complicated.
Right. Well, certainly in the case of public officials, we have to err on the side of retaining records once they're created. And while I think it was just a massive error to record this meeting without consent, I think the administration was right to preserve the recording and to respond to the open records request as it did.
That's interesting because it did exist. And the reason we're able to hear audio from it is almost kind of separate from how it came about in the first place. There are two different conversations here.
Right. And I think the outlet that initially published it, the Journal Sentinel, they had to go through some reasoning themselves about, you know, knowing that this was recorded the way that it was, should they be running this? Was the information important enough? Was it truly in the public interest or was it just salacious? And I think, you know, given the content of the meeting, I think you could make an argument, a strong argument, that it served the public interest to publish.
So that's it, right. It's not automatic that just because something is public that news outlets have to report it or replay it. There's another layer of ethical considerations that has to happen when media are considering whether to use the information.
Right. So, you know, if Voss and Evers had been saying, oh, that Katie Culver, she's just such a twit. I think you might have an argument that should not be published, that if it was just sort of a gossipy kind of session, that it doesn't serve the public interest to have it put out there. But they were talking about state response to a pandemic, and that certainly did serve the public interest to know what was happening in that meeting.
Yeah, certainly not a black and white issue here as we go through trying to discern the gray area of what's ethical when we have recorded phone calls or video calls. What's on your mind about this? 800-642-1234. Do you think it makes a difference if people are public officials or should we follow the same ethical guidelines regardless? Have you ever recorded a phone conversation so that you had the record for it? What did you do with that? And did you let the other person know or ask them about it, even if it was legal? 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. As we try to slow the spread of the contagious coronavirus, we're spending more time apart, but that doesn't necessarily mean less communication. We're on phone calls and conference lines. We're logging to Zoom and FaceTime and WebEx and Google Meets and more. So what, if any, privacy do we have? Could what we're saying be recorded legally? How about ethically? We're asking those questions and yours here on the Ideas Network. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're talking digital communication and privacy these days with Katie Culver. She's an associate professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And Marty from Lake Geneva is on the line. Good morning, Marty.
Hello?
Hi, Marty.
This isn't Marty.
Okay, sounds great. Are we talking with Gary from Iron River then? Oh, I'm not sure what's happening with the phones, but we'll go back to them in just a minute because we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And Katie, we did have a question from Marty in Lake Geneva who was trying to clarify a little bit more about like the consent here, because the person who recorded the phone call with Governor Evers and legislative leaders wasn't a reporter who recorded the call. So Marty was wondering if they have more leeway there.
They don't have any more legal leeway, so the consent requirements apply to all. But ethically, they may say, well, I'm not a reporter, so I don't have to follow journalism ethics. But in this case, I think journalism ethics are a good guideline for others. You know, these are questions that have been hammered out in newsrooms over decades and lots of controversial cases that give us some guidance. I think you saw a lot of people of all political stripes saying, this doesn't feel right that this was secretly recorded, you know. And I think that sort of unease in the gut should make you think about what kinds of reasoning we could apply to this. And I think the reasoning that we get out of not just journalism ethics, but professional ethics overall, whether it's right to record something in a board meeting, for instance, is a common question in business ethics. So I think these professional ethics that have been honed over decades can provide guidance in these kinds of situations.
All right. We've got a question from Gary in Iron River. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, ladies. Say, I'd like to understand more about how specific the open records request had to be. And I'm trying to find out, does that mean that the fact that a recording existed had to be leaked for the reporter to make the correct open records request? And then one could conclude perhaps the intent of the recording was to leak it and make it public.
Yeah, I'm not sure on the intent, Gary, and certainly I think people are talking about that. But the question of, does somebody have to know about a record for us to ask for the record, Katie?
No, that's a fantastic question, Gary. It's something that's often misunderstood. So open records requests are made with specificity for documents relating to, relating to a certain situation, but they're usually very expansive in the request. So the request may include language, and there are all sorts of boilerplate letters out there, but it may include language saying any records related to to gubernatorial action in response to the Supreme Court order. These may include, but not be limited to, paper records, emails, recordings. So the records requests are usually written to rope in as many records as possible.
So then the person being asked to provide things then has to determine what fits in this category. What do I need to turn over to be following the law?
Correct. So there's a records custodian for each level and branch and agency, and they make a determination of what is and is not a record. So one of the things that often gets discussed is whether something is a draft, which does not have to be released. But in this case, I think Governor Evers' administration correctly concluded that this was a record that needed to be released. So while, you know, some may suspect that there was, you know, something afoot here to try to leak it and get the recording out, I think it's very plausible and in fact probable that this was just merely a response to a well-written records request.
We've got Ben from West Salem who has a question during our conversation here. Hi, Ben.
Hi. I am a medical patient. I make lots of calls across the country for medical needs, and I'm wondering, I was listening to this conversation and intrigued, how does that the federal law, being that not all states are single-party consent, how does that apply, say, when I call California and they record my conversation? And my concern is I'm giving my medical information and quite a bit of details out for for some of this medical equipment. Am I able to tell them I wish it not to be recorded? Or how would I do that?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Ben. Katie, where do we start here?
Well, I would never want to give legal advice because I am not an expert on patient privacy, but I would expect that you would be able to assert your HIPAA rights, your federal healthcare privacy rights. And it's important to note that in records cases, kind of like the one that we're talking about now, any open record, there is an automatic exemption for other privacy laws. So your health privacy rights are protected. Your health records are not open records. Student privacy rights are respected. So you can't get my transcript from the University of Wisconsin without my consent. In general, I would say you should have the expectation that no interaction with a healthcare professional it should be recorded without your consent. They shouldn't be keeping records without your consent. And under the healthcare privacy laws, you do have a right to consult someone about the keeping of your records within an organization. So you can contact, say, an ombudsperson to ask about record keeping to make sure that your privacy needs are being met.
All right. Thanks for the question, Ben. We're talking about privacy issues in the digital age with Katie Culver. She specializes in journalism ethics at UW-Madison. And we've got Tom from Madison who also wants to weigh in here. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, I just have a couple comments. I believe that these are public servants and all conversations and interactions they have need to be 100% transparent. They are paid with taxpayer dollars. Secondly, this is, to me, seems like just a distraction from the, at a minimum, insensitive remarks made by Robin Voss. And third, it should be expected that everything legislators say in a formal meeting should not only be available, but published. I would like to see the minutes published in the newspaper.
Tom,
every
thanks.
Single meeting they have.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for that. Katie, Tom's really hitting on transparency here.
And I think we have a long tradition of transparency and open government in Wisconsin, and but it has been facing some threats lately. I think, Tom, I agree with you in spirit, and yet there are times when we do need our public servants to be hammering things out in private, or we're not going to make progress. So there are some issues in which you need preliminary negotiations, drafting of documents, that if everything were public, we might not move forward. I would agree with you that I think we've swung too far toward the opaque in government in the state, and I'd like to see us move back toward those open traditions. One of the things that I found heartening here was the response to the open records request, that we didn't get into some sort of, you know, long, drawn-out debate about whether this should be released or even litigation that the newspaper would have had to fight to gain access. So there is a little ray of hope there. But I think open government does not have to mean 100% transparency at every moment. But it also cannot mean that government officials try hard to hide behind the opacity that they do have.
Katie, George Floyd's death and his treatment by Minneapolis police officers have gained incredible national attention, in part because a bystander captured video footage of an officer kneeling on his neck as he died. What are our limits on recording the police, especially in public?
This has been such a hot topic, and something that, honestly, if you'd asked me 20 years ago was even an open question, I would have said you're out of your mind. The idea that a citizen cannot trigger a recording of police in a public space, it just stuns me that we would even have that conversation. I can walk down to State Street and record protesters with my cell phone camera. So why I would not be able to record police is just a kind of a crazy question to me. But it is something that is being argued in some jurisdictions, not here in Wisconsin that I'm aware of, though I could easily be wrong in that. But you know, trying to certain jurisdictions trying to pass legislation or ordinances that protect police from being recorded doing their duties in public. If you are on a public street, you can be recorded, and I think that should apply equally to police.
Yeah, so when you put your journalism ethics hat on, you're saying, you know, trying to understand why there would be a distinction between public officials or just regular people out and about and law enforcement. They should all be treated the same in public.
Well, you know, to sort of harken back to what Tom was saying, I think there is an obligation that they should be more recordable if they are public servants than if they are just you know, the average citizen. So, you know, given that you are doing the public's business, you are ultimately accountable to the public, and recordings of your activities can be argued to be part of that.
All right, Katie, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Katie Culver is an associate professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. She's also the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics. Up next is news, then learn why every kid who's in state custody at Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake is getting letters from people who care about them, people they probably don't even know. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. We're learning about the decision to shut down a paper mill in central Wisconsin. Hundreds of people are losing their jobs. A reporter explains what's happening and how it fits in with what's happening in the paper industry and in the economy. That conversation is ahead. Now, kids who are incarcerated in Wisconsin are getting letters from people who support them, even though they've never met. It started as a national effort called Care Mail. Volunteers want to offer kids in custody some encouragement, especially during the pandemic, as they've lost other connections. Lance Horsheski is the assistant administrator for Wisconsin's Division of Juvenile Corrections. Lance, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
The National Care Mail program started in April. How did people wind up writing to kids in custody here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so we developed a partnership with Dane County Restorative Justice. The Peacemaker Volunteers got organized, and we developed a partnership to have those volunteers start writing letters to youth who are in secure custody at our Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake facility. So they've developed a group that has collectively started writing letters to youth, ensuring every youth at the facility gets a letter at least once a week.
Did you just say ensuring every youth at the facility gets a letter at least once a week?
That is correct. So several volunteers write multiple letters to multiple youth, but we do have a commitment to make sure every youth gets at least one letter.
And what does that do for kids? I mean, what's their response to that? Because that's a lot of communication that otherwise wouldn't happen necessarily.
Yeah, it's a great connection beyond kind of their family connections that they're having more video contacts right now. But it's connected them to the broader community of volunteers that are reaching out, really letting kids know kind of what's happened in the community, but something about them as a person, but also letting the community know that they care about these kids and they care about their futures and really encourage them to engage in the programming and get on a better track.
Yeah, what is kids' response to the fact that now they have these pen pals that they've never met before?
So we haven't gotten feedback from the youth as of yet, but there's a lot of just inquisitiveness from the kids, I think. Like, why, you know, what's the interest in? So we plan on surveying the kids in the future. We do a lot of feedback with our youth now and just get their feedback, what is working, what isn't. So, yeah, right now we're just hearing anecdotal information about curiosity from the youth, but really a lot of the volunteers have great life stories, and it's a great opportunity to make a connection that they normally wouldn't have.
And are people still able to volunteer? If I'm hearing this and I think, wow, I'd really like to be a part of something like that, to talk to some of these kids, what options do I have?
We're new into this, we have volunteers that are writing multiple letters. So if there's an opportunity, if someone wants to reach out to the Dane County Restorative Justice team. I think we're always looking for volunteers. We hope to sustain this over the long term. We know it's kind of a heavy lift being able to write weekly letters to, 70, 80 kids a week, but it's a really important aspect to make this connection between community and youth, despite being in secure confinement, that there's still a connection, and that connection is really important. So yes, as this moves along, we will be potentially looking for more volunteers and have that opportunity in the future, we hope.
Has this kind of interaction with people outside of these facilities seemed to maybe matter more now that we have further restrictions on how we can interact and where we are because of COVID-19?
It is absolutely a new and critical piece because of the safety restrictions, because of COVID-19, like you said, that we're not able to have volunteers come into the facility. So finding these new ways to connect with youth is really important, because of the lack of the ability for volunteers to come in or other service providers, that this is just another way to let kids know and to have connections with community.
And how are you dealing with that when it comes to physical and mental health for kids who are in custody when we're dealing with a contagious disease? I mean, it's sickened thousands of people in our state.
So first and foremost, we really start with education. We have healthcare staff, nurses that do a lot of education. We have videos. We have new ability to stream videos throughout the facility that kids can watch our healthcare staff interact with them personally, because we have nurses on staff that work with youth, but also have videos. So that's kind of our first point of sharing information, educating youth about the virus and how to, cleanliness and all the care that we're doing. Why staff are wearing masks, and all those things that we're doing in a broader community, we're doing for our youth. And then second, really, we have a very strong clinical team of psychologists who really interact with youth and talk to them and interact with them and to be able to hear and process their concerns, mostly around their family, who they have a lot of questions about, are they safe in their communities and what is being done. So we have a strong social work team. Our direct care staff are very well educated around this, of this, what's happening. So we have a strong clinical team that can support you with all the concerns and issues.
Lance Horsheski is the Assistant Administrator for Wisconsin's Division of Juvenile Corrections, and we're talking about supporting kids who are in custody. And one of the ways that we're doing that is a program that connects people in custody with people on the outside through letter writing. And one thing I want to ask Lance about letter writing is, how is security managed here? How do you make sure that no one takes advantage of these kids through the mail?
Right. That's a great question. That's why we're partnering with Dane County Restorative Justice Peacemakers. So that organization is well established in the Dane County community. They have volunteers that they do background checks on. And also, we also partner with the Center for Educational Excellence in Alternative Settings. So they're really the centerpiece of this, where the volunteers write letters. They're all uploaded into the database with the Center for Educational Excellence. They do a cursory review of the letters just to make sure that everything that's being written is okay and appropriate for youth. And then those get forwarded on to our facility. And ultimately, the volunteers don't have the identity of the youth. So we continue with the confidentiality of these youth. So it is a one-way communication. So that's how we balance kind of the safety and the confidentiality of our youth through this process.
Have you been able to read any of the letters yourself?
I have not at this point, but the feedback that I've gotten from our deputy superintendent up at the facility is kind of a similar feedback of some of the volunteers have just amazing stories about immigrating to the United States, as an example, and telling their story, and just great stories that these kids get to read about. So, yeah, I look forward to being able to read some of the letters in the future. Just haven't had the time, but the feedback that I've gotten from others is it's a very powerful communication.
Why is that so powerful, especially for these kids who are away from their families?
It's just that connection that someone is taking the time to write to them, to tell them about themselves, some of their stories, about how they care about them. I think there's a lot of power and communities and volunteerism with youth that don't have much of any contact with communities. And that can be a really powerful tool in each one of these youth recovery and journey through treatment to get back to the community.
And how many kids are in state facilities in 2020, and how many of them can receive these letters right now?
So right now, our census is around 78 youth at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, which is boys, both boys and girls. So, you know, as our census goes up and goes down, we work with our volunteers to make sure that each youth is getting a letter.
What is a good takeaway that somebody who might be listening should know about what you're trying to do here?
I think one of the key takeaways is all our desire as, you know, as we go through and reform our facility up there at Lincoln Hills and really bring it to the forefront of a secure confinement treatment facility, is that having a connection to the community and having connection to family is really at the forefront of what we're trying to do with youth up there. And whether it's letter writing or kids getting Zoom calls with their families and seeing dogs in the house, you know, yes, this COVID-19 has really been a challenge in operating the facility, but there's been incredible opportunities come out of this. And like letter writing, like Zoom calls, like different connections, we found ways to get creative and continue to make connections for youth in their journey to recovery.
Lance, thank you for taking the time to explain this to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for the time. I appreciate the offer.
That was Lance Orszewski. He's the Wisconsin Division of Juvenile Corrections Assistant Administrator. And we talked about care mail. Project organizers have tips for what to write about and what people shouldn't put in those notes. You can find more information about connecting with kids who are in confinement by visiting this story on our website. You can find it at wpr.org/mornings. This conversation is happening on The Morning Show, and up next, we've got a WPR reporter who's ready to talk about the economic downturn when it comes to paper mills, a central Wisconsin paper mill that's been operating for more than 100 years is shutting down this summer, and that means hundreds of people are losing their jobs, and we're going to talk about that with WPR's Rob Bentzer, and we're taking your calls. You can give us a call right now at 800-642-1234. Do you work in Wisconsin's paper industry? Have you experienced a paper mill closing in your part of the state? What do you want other communities to know, and how has it affected your life? There's a line for you right now at 800-642-1234. Maybe you worked in the paper industry in the past. What's changed? And what do you think is coming for this industry here in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. The largest employer in Wisconsin Rapids is shutting down by the end of next month. The Verso Paper Mill has been in operation since 1904, and the shutdown leaves almost 1,000 people without work. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and there's room for you in our conversation. Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. Has a paper mill shut down in your community? What do you want people to know about that? Maybe you work in the paper industry. Where do you see its future here in Wisconsin? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Rob Mentzer is Wisconsin Public Radio's rural communities reporter based in Wausau, and he's covering this story. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What led to this decision to shut down the Verso Mill?
Well, so this is a sort of follow-on effect of COVID-19 and the recession. So this mill in particular produced like a coated glossy paper that's used in magazines, and magazine business is way down as advertising shut down and, you know, other sort of media travails that we've heard about in the COVID recession. So with demand down for that product, this is the result that they're idling the mill. The company Verso says that they are idling the mill, which implies that it could restart again, it could be sold, or it could close, and we just don't know what the sort of longer term future will be for the mill.
And that's actually language that we've heard before with these operations,
right? And I don't want to say that it's we have seen buyers emerge, and it is not necessarily the case that this mill will be closed forever, but we don't know, and because we don't know, there's also, you know, the very real possibility that you know, that there won't be a buyer, the company won't restart production here, or if they do, it will be months away, or could be a lot fewer workers. You know, it's a lot of unknowns, but it doesn't look great.
The Verso Mill, as we mentioned, the largest employer in Wisconsin Rapids. How many jobs are at stake here?
So there are about 900 jobs in the Wisconsin Rapids mill, which is the largest employer in that city. It's a city of about 20,000 people or so, a little less. And Verso announced at the same time they're also closing a mill in Duluth, Minnesota, that I think, you know, probably some folks in Superior work at, but that mill has been in decline for quite a while, and at this point employs only about 100 people. So the impact there is less in northern Wisconsin.
How will the closing affect workers? I mean, with these layoffs, are there some sort of severance package involved?
I don't know that. I do know that you know, state officials and agencies are working to respond to the workers. I think that it's very likely that there are some additional aid, you know, sort of unemployment aid that they can access. Of course, they'll be eligible for unemployment as they're laid off, and they're, you know, politicians and leaders are trying to arrange a response that will connect them with training resources, job opportunities, and so on. So there are, you know, there are some opportunities available, but at the same time, like, you know, so this is the nature of paper mills jobs, right? Is a lot of times people got these jobs and expect to work in a paper mill for 30 years or whatever. And so if you've have this like long history at this company, it still is a trauma and quite a thing to face to have to like find something else to do.
We're discussing the closing of the Verso Mill in central Wisconsin with Rob Menser. Rob is Wisconsin Public Radio's rural communities reporter, and he's based in Wausau. And we're going over what the closure, whether temporary or long term, what it means for the community and for people who work there. Rob, what's the timeline for this again?
So this the mill will be closed down by the end of July.
And do we know then when layoffs are expected to start? Will everybody be able to work until July 31st? Do we have guidance from the company?
I think that you know, there's a process to closing these things down. They'll close down, you know, bit by bit, different machines will close. So I think that the layoffs will be somewhat spread out over that period. But I don't know the specifics on that. I think that it's safe to say that many workers will be laid off before the you know, July 31st.
How can we begin to gauge how this will affect the local economy?
It really is a massive blow to Wisconsin Rapids, and it does have these ripple effects. There are a lot of ancillary businesses that exist in central Wisconsin around the paper mill. That could be, you know, trucking companies. This affects loggers as well. There are a lot of logging companies in central and northern Wisconsin whose primary client has been this mill, and so they'll have to find another, you know, other customers or figure out something else to do. And those are just a couple of examples of the ways that the effects of it sort of ripple out. But it's a major loss, and I think that it is the sort of thing that can reshape the economy.
Sure, because some of these in smaller communities, there are just fewer places where people work and they rely on those jobs because they're close to home, or that's one of the reasons they live there. So certainly it helps define rural communities in Wisconsin. We've got Dave from Green Bay on the line who wants to talk about this. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Well, I'm 64 years old, but I had started in 79 at Fort Howard Paper Company in Green Bay, which is purchased by Georgia Pacific now. And in 2005, they did a major house cleaning and what they actually did in there was to automate their mill. And so there was a lot of people they didn't need. There was 200, 300, almost 500 people given severances, and if you want to leave, you can leave. But when that happened, the company did offer training, like through NWTC, some paid training if you took the package to leave, which I did. But the problem with a lot of those paper mills is years ago, you could get a job there, make good money, retire from there. That's not the case anymore because things change. Markets change. Automation comes in where they might need 20 people on a machine. Now they only need five. And that's what happened with Fort Howard and Georgia Pacific. But what I did is I always drove truck part-time. This is odd. And I had a CDL. So when that happened, I took the buyout and went driving truck, which worked out great for me. I mean, I'm going to retire in a year. I mean, I didn't have to dip into any 401k or anything. But what I would say to these folks, if there's any job training coming along, don't wait for that mill to open up again. There's so many people that are 40 years old or, been in that mill since they were 18. And we're so heartbroken, and what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Because they totally depended on that place. I said, hey, go to school. Reinvent yourself. That's what a lot of people did, and it turned out better for them in the long run.
Dave, thanks so much for that. And Rob, that Dave does share it. Thank you for sharing your story, Dave, first. And also, Rob, what about the unemployed workers? Are local officials going to be able to help them retrain or find new work?
Well, it's certainly available, and like the Department of Workforce Development, there's the North Central region here is absolutely making those opportunities available, and I think Dave, he shares what he's saying is very real, which is that there is a mentality among some workers that like this is my job for life, right? And that was something that was very true in a lifestyle 30 years ago, and it's just less and less true today. And so it's honestly it's kind of true across a lot of different industries, but it's definitely true in the paper industry workers need to be prepared to broaden their skills and hopefully find opportunities to something that would step into the place if these paper mill jobs don't come back.
Rob, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Rob Mentzer is Wisconsin Public Radio's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.